Welcome to Coming Up for Air, the Allies in Recovery podcast, with hosts Laurie McDougall, Kayla Solomon, and Dominique Simone Levine.
Today's topic is, we're kind of calling it like a gap in the continuum of care for our loved ones who enter into treatment. And what we're talking about is the time frame when our loved ones maybe have been in long-term treatment or residential treatment, and maybe they've transitioned into a recovery home, and now they're transitioning out of a recovery home, and they're either going back home, or maybe they're headed into their own living space. But it's this gap when they get out of that structured environment, and now they're left on their own. And this is actually a high time when things can start to fall apart and we may see a recurrence. And so I was really, really hoping we could talk about that today, because it happens frequently. Any ideas, ladies, on why it is that there might be a high likelihood of a recurrence during this kind of transition out of this structured environment into just, now you take all of the reins and get going?
I think there's a few reasons. I think one of them is that a lot of people do not like transitions in general. So let's put that on the table. You're in a situation, it's very clear what the rules are. There's people holding the space for you. There's people with their eyeballs on you. You're accountable to somebody. And then what happens is there's a change. And if we really look at the system that's in place, there's not a lot of continuity of care. A lot of times people kind of get, I feel like they get shot out of a cannon. They're like in this very closed environment, and then boom, they're out there with the expectation that they're going to do well based on the skills that they have or that they learned in the program. The irony, and just so you know, as a clinician, I cannot tell you how many times people who have been using substances have come in and said to me, I could teach this class. I could run this program. I know all of this. And as I like to say, there's a gap between what you learn and what you know and what you do. And I really feel like the transition time, when people are not clear about where they're going or what the structure that they're even establishing is the time when the doing part gets tested and the temptation also gets increased because there's not a lot of accountability.
I actually think it's incredibly complicated as to why this happens. I think it's great that you go into a treatment program, you start to learn new skills and new strategies. A lot of these treatment programs teach a lot of what we teach with CRAFT in Allies in Recovery. The loved one is also learning a lot of these communication skills, a lot of these life strategies. I think that when you're in treatment and in a structured environment, all you have to focus on is that. That's it. And then you get back out into life. You've never had a trigger. You've been learning these skills kind of in a vacuum, and you never had a trigger to actually deal with. So now you're expected to, without any structure, without, you know, having really practiced those skills, you have to start implementing those skills without having been triggered before. I hear family members say, but they were doing so good. And, you know, my own loved one, he really believed when he came out of treatment, he was going to be good. And I believed, he believed it. And I believe he was trying. I don't think he had enough practice when the trigger came along. And it's like the same thing with us family members who are learning CRAFT. We have to learn how to regulate our emotions, and we're not good at it in the beginning. We get triggered and we can't figure out why we can't calm ourselves down. Well, I think it's true of our loved ones too. You're in a structured environment. All you're doing is you're focusing on your recovery. You're going to groups. You're getting up at a specific time because you're being told you have to. you're making your bed, you're doing your thing, you're going to groups, you're just totally focused. Yep, this is what I'm going to do. Oftentimes they can go to a gym, get some exercise. Either they have to cook for themselves now, or maybe they already have someone cooking for them. So they're eating 3 square meals a day. Everything's going along fine, right? And they're in there for a while. Oh yeah, no, I got this. I got this. I feel great. I got this. And then they go home and the old friends that you used to drink with are there. Just old memories of having done something in a specific room. The other thing that a lot of family members don't really understand is how deep those triggers are. So they don't just trigger a memory. They trigger a memory, they trigger a physical and mental response in the person on something that is very difficult to deal with and very complicated. And that's hard. And now you're expected to go back to those skills and strategies that you learned in 30 days or even 6 months. And it's not easy. It's not easy to do.
The system's always been organized around this sort of episodic care, right? We don't see addiction as an ongoing chronic condition or one that's going to take some management for the rest of your life. You get treated, you come out, you're supposed to be okay. And that's still the way it works in the majority of treatment. So we shouldn't be surprised that they get drop kicked out of a structured inpatient residential housing program, go back to their old neighborhood, your home nearby, something, and feel like they've dropped off a cliff in terms of having to now navigate a whole different system. If you want to plug back into the kind of structure and good messaging and group and fellowship and everything that you're going to need on back in the community. So my friend John Fitzgerald is fond of saying, you know, it comes about even whether your loved one goes inpatient or your loved one stays in their community and gets outpatient wraparound services in the community. They both have their advantages. You do see this wonderful period of retreat and focus on recovery that an inpatient program provides. But as we've both been saying, the lack of practice, the coming home to, you know, where was the last time I hid that little bag of dope? You know, so everything is just lighting up for you at home, and you better have all your ducks in a row. And the treatment program has probably done very little. I'm afraid they don't really, really work on aftercare the way we want you to, and the way we end up asking you, the family, to do so. So you're going to have to help set up these options like you did before of what are they going to do for their medication? What are they going to do for their psychiatry? What are they going to do for mutual aid groups that they like or can discover? Or, you know, so all of this stuff, you can't come home from 90 days or 6 months to a different environment and just expect yourself to be able to pull all this together for yourself. You just won't. You won't. You'll sit there and you'll get scared and you'll have old feelings and it'll be hard to get moving. And I've seen this happen time and time again. And the families, you know, the loved one gets back into the home environment, their home or your home, and they don't do anything for their recovery. And the families are so scared at this point because they've seen such great advances during the treatment phase, this inpatient away from home treatment phase. And now things are kind of not coming together the way they should. And somehow it's supposed to, but let's be clear here, there's nobody doing it. You need case management skills. You need people at the treatment program linking with phone calls to the community level saying, we've got somebody coming your way. Have you got a slot for your men's recovery group? You know, so, which is what we end up training families to do, is to find all this little nitty gritty stuff in the community that they're returning to. Big hole. And that's what we call resourcing the family, is providing the family some help in discovering all this. It's a lot of work and you need some help with it. It's not going to come second nature to you either.
The trigger piece is huge here because I hate to say this, but as family members, you're part of the trigger. The dance that we've had with our loved ones for years and years and years, when you think about a trigger, it's something old that something in the present pushes and the past comes rolling up and you're back in the past. So you're not actually present at the moment when you're triggered. That's why the reaction never seems balanced, because it's like, what just happened? What did I miss? But it's because there's a button that reminds you of something that was very activating in the past, and you basically lose time. What we're talking about here, Dominique's talking about the case management piece, which means that what resources are out there. And again, we are very wide ranging when we talk about resources, because we're talking about gym membership and we're talking about being active and we're talking about community and we're talking about getting engaged with family members. There's all kinds of things. It's not just treatment. It's about a life. It's about helping the person get back engaged in life, which is not easy, because part of the knife's edge that we're talking about here is that you're part of this process, but you can't be overly part of the process, because that's old. The old part is, I'm going to do all of this for you. I'm going to be brilliant and have all of these great resources for you. And you have to do this. And that's part of the dance that doesn't work.
You know, I'm glad you bring that up, because I think that, yes, we absolutely are a trigger. Like you said, there's established memories, preconceived ideas and beliefs about what I'm saying to you, about how I'm interacting with you, that absolutely triggers all sorts of emotions and different feelings in our loved ones. But I also think that there is a part of this that it gets amped up even more when our loved ones come home. And we as family members have to be fully, fully aware of our own. That's a trigger for us. When they're not doing what we think they should be doing, we become anxious. We become, you know, oh my gosh, he should have gone to 15 million different mutual aid groups and he's not going to any. Oh my God, right? He missed his doctor's appointment. He skipped this. And I keep telling him he's got to go out and get a job. When the heck is he going to start working? And right. When we do that, we really start placing a lot of pressure on our loved ones, and they are not equipped yet to deal with that. They are dealing with their own crap that's in this gap area where they're trying to transition back into just life. So it is so important to get in there and learn those craft skills. So important to learn how to back down, how to pull away, how to give your loved one space, but also encourage them in a way that's going to move them forward, which is everything, which is all of craft, right? Especially those communication skills, helping us to learn how to do a lot more listening, a lot less pushing, be a lot more understanding, because there's actually lots of incredible communication skills that can help you with this, but also learning to self-regulate our own emotions and our own, which I think is key across the board. But also, as Dominique said, be prepared. How are you going to resource these things with your loved one? A lot of the time, family members don't even think about it. They just go, oh yeah, you can come home. Or they're, and then they get anxious. Oh my God, they're coming home, right? Right? And they have no plan. They've got nothing. This is a line of thinking that is incredibly common in family members. And Kayla, you've actually brought it up, but this isn't. I see this all the time. I'll just make it nice and easy around here, so that all they have to focus on is their recovery. I'll just tiptoe around and make everything nice and easy. So actually, that's not it, right? It's this balance of not too much pushing, more encouragement, backing off, also being aware that your loved one isn't perfect. In fact, they're not even close to perfect. They're struggling. They're really, really struggling when they come home. 30 days, I don't care, 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months in treatment, in a residential treatment, even if they go to a recovery home, is still not a great response to 20 years of building up to these difficult, challenging problems. If it took you this long to get to the point where you are, expect it to be a long journey on the other side as well. And there may be moments when your loved one has a recurrence. That's also not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. But be prepared, like what Dominique said, with those resources and communication skills so that you can help encourage your loved one into those resources. And have discussions about this before they come home. Have discussions about, okay, I see you're really putting so much effort into this. You're really, really putting your all into this. And I can see that you're feeling really good about a few things. Let's talk about when the struggles come up. Can we talk about what's the plan? Do you have a plan? Where do you want to go with this? There's actually a lot the family can do, but it's a lot of work. Be prepared.
And basically what we talk about with at Allies is preparation. That it's not, we're not looking at outcome. We're not looking at being massively successful. That's a setup. We're not looking at what your expectation is of this other person, because you can't have expectations. It's really just about living in the moment and having really good communication. And the hope that I would have is that when somebody's coming out of treatment program, that maybe they're into communicating a little bit more than if they're just floating out there. And just to add to what Lori said, I think being curious and interested in what your loved one is thinking is really an essential part of this, as opposed to having your brilliant recommendations and referrals and suggestions. Just really try to have a communication about what they're thinking and what they want and what would work for them. And that's huge. That's really huge, because a lot of times we don't ask, or we ask with judgment and expectation. And we have to back up and just start having conversations with the other person. And there's the other element of this, which we go back to. If you can have an opportunity before they come home to make an agreement with them about what the expectations are, and then just continue that discussion when they come back. But they have to be a realistic expectations. It's not that you want to have pie in the sky and then you're guaranteeing failure. That's not the way this works.
I'm glad you bring that up too, because I think that's a really important piece, because I think a lot of the time family members will put some expectations in there or kind of like some guidelines, but it's actually a setup. And not aware that it is, but it's a setup that the loved one can't fulfill, just not yet. There's just total devastation and fallout because the loved one struggles with living up to those particular expectations. And a lot of the time I will see family members trying to go, well, you can't do this. And if this happens, you're going to have to do that. And you're going to have to do that. And then the loved one agrees to it. Yep, I can do it. I can do it. And everybody's like, okay, great. And then we as family members are sitting around watching and waiting. We're waiting for that hammer to drop, But you said you were gonna, now you're not, you know. But ultimately in the end, it wasn't a great plan to begin with. So it's one of those things that it was too rigid or it wasn't fluid enough, which it's okay for a plan to be fluid. In other words, you can come up with a plan, have it not work, and then adjust the plan to make it so that it works. It's okay to change things up. I totally agree with you. Have a plan, have an agreement as to what's going to happen or what the expectations are. Be prepared that the expectations can't be fulfilled, and have a backup plan for that. And don't be so rigid. Be willing to adjust a plan to figure out what is going to work with the family. I had to do this with my loved one. We had to adjust our plan multiple times. And yes, he had been in treatment. He had been in a recovery home. He had done all of that. He was coming back home. And I needed to know that he was going to be in an IOP. He had already done treatment and all of that. But I needed to know, no, you're coming back home. There's going to be triggers. Can you go into an IOP? If not, where are you going to go? because I need to know, these are things that I need to know you're going to be working on. And I also needed to know that he would be open, that if things went off the rails, that he would be open to something else, to adding or doing the IOP again, or whatever it was. And he was open to that stuff. And we did have recurrences. We did have moments where things were incredibly challenging. I can't tell you guys how many times he went into an IOP. I can't even count. But you know what? That's what it took.
So all you can do is sort of get a verbal agreement that if this doesn't work, we're going to be looking at these additional things that may need to be added. Do you agree to take a look at that if there's reoccurrence, if you start getting really unable to hang on here? That's it. That's as good a contract as you're going to get. It doesn't mean they'll do it when the time comes. It just means that you've had this conversation and you've agreed to it at one point. It's got to be good enough, because that's all there is.
Make sure that you know what you're going to do if they don't follow through, because that's an important piece. And I always did this with my loved one. I always had made it very clear that, okay, if this isn't working for you, well, actually, I guess I presented it more to him of, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to do an IOP? Do you want to do residential? What is it that you're going to do next? Because it ain't safe right here, right now in my house. And which doesn't mean he can't come back later on. He can come back later on, but right now it's not safe. And he was the one, I left it up to him to pick where do you want to go and what do you want to do? And he did. There were times he chose residential. There were times he chose a recovery home. When I saw that there was a lot more effort on his part, that's when I kind of relaxed and was like, well, an IOP, why don't you just go right into an IOP? And what I mean by that is, let's say he had 6 months of recovery under his belt. He got a job, he tried to go to school, and then he had a recurrence, right? Something happened, he had a recurrence. And then it was like, typically if he had a recurrence, like in the first 6 weeks, that was, okay, where are you going? Residential? Or recovery home that's got some structure in it, where are you going to go? But if it was 6 months and he had been working really hard and trying all these things and it was just a couple of days he had a recurrence, then it was like, okay, talk to me. How are we going to get you back on track? And then he was the one, I can do an IOP. Let me go back into an IOP. And there were times when it was like, okay, why don't you leave your job? Go into the IOP, focus on that, or leave your class, drop your class for now, go into the IOP, focus on that, and then let's get you back on track and we'll take it from there. And I can't tell you, he did an IOP, gosh, I can't even count how many times he did one, but it got to the point where even he was saying, you know what, Mom, I really want to go back into an IOP. Not because I think I'm going to learn a whole heck of a lot, but because I think I need the structure.
And just for those who don't know, IOP stands for Intensive Outpatient Program. Here's the other question that I think we need to address, which is the people that come out of treatment and they sleep all day and they just don't do anything. They just sleep all day. I think this happens a lot. So I think we need to address that, because that freaks everybody out. It is so disturbing to look at your loved one and they're doing absolutely nothing. They're not leaving the house. They're not taking care of things around the house. They sometimes are not taking care of themselves. And we need to address this, because I think that is possibly one of the most triggering positions that the family members have put in. It's like you're watching this person and you had all of these hopes for what was going to happen. And this is what you're getting, which is somebody who has become, you know, sedentary and couch potato like.
Well, I think you got to expect extreme depression and anxiety. You know, you take away the substance and you then take away a structure in a community. And now you are in your old living space with triggers, with people that trigger you, with no friends, right? With nothing. You better expect anxiety and depression. You, as a family member, you better expect that this is going to happen. But there are little things that you can do to try and help your loved one move through it. One, don't panic. Don't panic. And also, kind of what Kayla alluded to earlier, start to listen. That's exactly what happened with us, Kayla, with my son. In the beginning, that's all he did. And I didn't bother him. You know, I would go in and check on him. Hey, you want a cup of coffee? Or and you could just see the depression was just overwhelming. And maybe because I myself have experienced depression, I understood. So it wasn't like I'm not gonna go out of my way to push him to do anything. So I didn't. And I started to hear little things. Like, he came to me one day and he said, "I know it's expensive." And he said, "But could we please get some kind of a video game? It will help me take my mind off of what's going on inside of my head." And I was like, okay, it was expensive because we didn't have a video gaming system. So I had to buy the whole system and everything, but we did because I could see it. I could see what he was asking me. I'm not trying to pull wool over your eyes or get anything out of you. And we did. And since then, he played video games for hours on end. But since then, I've also learned that video gaming is actually a really positive piece for people that are in early recovery. It's kind of like a replacement behavior. It allows people to kind of take their mind off of everything that's going on there, right? Get them to focus on something that's not all that important. It's fun, and it allows people to process. And then the other thing that I didn't know this because I don't play video games, but a lot of the video games that they have out today, you play them with other people kind of in a community, and you can actually communicate back and forth. So I kind of was like, okay, I'm going to let that go. Let him play those video games for a while. And then I would do like little things, like on a Friday night, "Hey, Dad and I want to grab a bite to eat. Do you want to come?" And I would get no's for a while. And, okay, you don't have to. "Well, how about if we order a pizza and you just come out and we sit down and have the pizza? Maybe we could watch a movie together." You know, I might get a no, or I might get a yes. And he would come out just for the pizza. And then he'd say, "Yeah, I'm going to go back in the room and I don't want to watch a movie." Okay, you know, that's fine. Then eventually we got a yes for the Friday night going out. We did all sorts of like little things. We got a dog. We got a comfort dog for him. Animals can be companions, right? And really bring some level of comfort and joy to people. He wanted a puppy. We took him out. We went and got a puppy. We're dog people. So, but a lot of people like cats. Get a cat. Just little things. And little by little, he came out of that room. He played less video games. He was more than willing to go and get a job. It was a long process. It's not like it was a nice straight line process. He would take a class, then he would work for a while, then he would lose that job and get another job and then go back and take a class. And it was not this beautiful straight line. It was hilly, up and down. But it was also that very, very beginning stages of early recovery. He was just holding on for dear life. He was in deep depression, deep anxiety. And I had to find some way to just kind of back off, allow it to happen, and find little ways to help him.
The one thing I want to say about the little ways is one of the parents in the group said that one of the gifts that you have is you know what the person was like before they started using. You know what they used to like. And that's a gift that you have, even if you're a partner, because when you met them, even if they were using, they were more functional, they were more engaged in their life, I would hope. So you have this information about them that you get to have in your pocket. So like the example that this father did is they said that they knew that their kid liked playing tennis before time, so to speak. And so every day he would say, "I'm going to play tennis. Do you want to come with me?" Every day, "I'm going to play tennis. Would you like to come with me?" And he just kept asking and getting no's. It's kind of like what you were talking about, Lori. And then one day he said yes. And they went and they played tennis. And their son came back and he was like, that was really fun. I really enjoyed that. And if nothing else, it's an hour and a half, 2 hours of them not using. So plus they have, you know, a lot of these things that we're talking about can give you this sense of pleasure or joy or peace or ease for whatever amount of time it is. And that when we talk about recovery, that's what we're talking about, is like that you're recovering parts of yourself that you have lost, that you have left behind, that you have ignored. And so when you think about recovery as somebody taking the aspects of themselves that have been abandoned and putting them back together, that's what recovery is about to us. There's many, many ways to get there. But as a family member, your gift is to remind the person of who they were, not by saying, oh, remember you used to do this, because that's a guilty thing. But it's more like, I heard that there's really good cookies and cream ice cream at the ice cream shop right now. You interested? And they might say, oh, can you bring me back some? And that's where you have to make a decision. Like, you might say, sure. Or you could say, no, you know, I'd like you to come with me because, you know, I just feel better if you would come with me and pick it out yourself. Something like that. So it's like you're getting the person out of this dumpy, lumpy situation where they're not moving or they're not doing anything. And you're giving them little glimmers of who they are, of life, of connection, meaning, whatever. We don't know what it's going to take. But also it's about being curious. I still think if you're curious and interested in them and you ask questions, not just about their drugs, but about, you know, I was listening to this music and, you know, I was wondering if you would like this, or I saw this article about this thing that you used to talk about all the time. Do you want me to show it to you? That kind of thing. So that you're reminding them that they're not just this person that is a substance user, but that there's this whole person. And that's the connection that we're talking about. Not just, did you go do this? Did you go do this? It's like, it's more about bringing in your knowledge of who they are and reminding them of that.
And this is the thing, is that we've got to remember, and I know that we don't understand how alluring making things fun is and how much it affects human behavior. And I saw two videos. They're called The Fun Theory. One is The Fun Theory, the piano stairs, and one is The Fun Theory, I think it's The Fun Theory 2, and it's all about dropping people in a park, dropping litter in a trash can, and the trash can makes this noise as if the litter is dropping into the center of the earth and then landing at the, and it's both of them. The other one is there's an escalator and there's stairs. And what they do is they show you this, I think it's in Stockholm where they did this, because it's through Volkswagen. But what they did was they videotaped people taking this escalator or taking the stairs. And everybody, for the most part, took the escalator in the beginning. And then what they did is they took the stairs and they put piano keys all over the stairs. So when you step on the stairs, you're playing music. About 66% of people stopped taking the escalator and started taking the stairs. And they weren't just taking the stairs, they were jumping on them and going from key to key and bringing their children and their dogs up the stairs. And that just shows you, without anybody saying anything, just making something a little bit more fun, you get people to do the work of climbing the stairs versus taking the escalator. And then they showed this garbage can in this park, and people would go over to the garbage can, drop their garbage in, and you'd hear bang, right? And everybody stops and they're over at the garbage can and they're looking inside. And then they got, like, families would take their kids and go pick up that trash over there, go pick up that trash over there. And people were literally cleaning the park so that they could hear the can drop. The reason why I'm telling these stories is because making things fun for someone is what's going to pull them out. Even if it's just a couple of minutes a day, even if it's just, hey, we got the basketball net out in the driveway, let's go shoot hoops for 5 minutes. Not this overwhelming thing, just a couple of minutes. So don't give up on those fun, joyous things. Reintroduce them in your family. you know, no matter what it is, if it's playing a game of Monopoly or watching a movie together or having pizza or playing tennis or shooting hoops, do whatever it is, just ask, expect a no, and then that wonderful day when you get that yes, celebrate.
Well, and there's always TikTok dances. Because there's nothing funnier than somebody of a certain age doing them. And so if my daughter says no, I'm going to do it, show it to her, and then don't think she won't be up there doing it with me.
There you go. Don't embarrass
me. So fine, you do it then. But that this is, I love that we're going to end on this note, because lighten your load, okay? This doesn't have to be heavy and serious and tragic and worrisome and filled with anxiety. Really, what we're talking about is reconnection. So instead of diving in with them to their depression and anxiety, just lighten yourself, work on yourself so that you're not as dragged down by whatever they're doing, but that you're able to be present and engage with them. And that's the work that we're asking you to do here at Allies, which we haven't said out loud, but it's alliesinrecovery.net if you're coming in through some other format. But we want you to look at yourself also. We want you to focus on yourself. We want you to focus on your own reactivity and your own triggers so that you could be more present, to be available for conversation and be curious about what the other person's going on and let go of expectations. And also, see if there's ways that you can actually connect in a lighthearted way with this person and not just be all heavy and treatment focused. Treatment is engagement. So if you're engaged in any positive way, you get to feel good about being part of the treatment process. And that's the transition that we're talking about. That's the one that works.
And you get to send the message by doing this. You get to send the message to your loved one that you believe that they are going to get through this.
And that they're bigger than their addiction.
Yep. Okay, ladies. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope this episode of Coming Up for Air spoke to you. If you're listening in today on a podcast platform that isn't the Allies member site, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating. This helps others find the show more easily. If you have a suggestion for a new topic or a guest for the show, please reach out through the Contact Us form on alliesinrecovery.net. Special thanks to our hosts, our guests, and our production team.